The Law of Equivalent Exchange. This is Tim in Tokyo with Patrick in Kumamoto. How's everything going?
It is cold, man.
Mm-hmm.
It is so cold. I'm taking these walks every morning, and my body is not liking it. But I told my body, you don't have to like it. You just have to do it.
So okay.
I am the boss of my body. But my body's kind of rebelling.
Yeah, it wasn't so bad here this morning. It was in the 40s. I go jogging, so...
Well, Tim, you've beaten me in the athletic competition.
Not absolutely every day, but basically the days that I don't have to get up early to go to teach school, which is three days a week. So I hope to try to jog 4 days a week.
I just can't jog. It's like my knees and my ankles and my hips have all signed some kind of secret, you know, conspiracy thing. They take turns making sure that running is not in my future. Walking, I can sneak by them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly what I do is I walk, I set up this group on Facebook called, Support Your Local Fat Ass, because I started this when I first moved to Kumamoto and I started walking and stuff. Mm-hmm. And in other words, the idea is to get up. I got to get up off my fat ass and do this exercise, which I hate to do. But what I do is like I shoot it live, and mostly I talk about like comics and movies and philosophy for like as I'm walking. And then, bam, I'm done before you know. So that's...
Okay.
I mention this podcast quite a bit.
Uh-huh. Okay, that's good. Yeah, I found as far as the running, if I don't do it for a while, then I think I lose muscle in my legs, and then it gets harder to do. Like last summer, not only did I not have school, but you know I had broken a rib while jogging, and so I didn't go jogging for about a month. And then when I tried to do it, my legs were kind of stiff, especially if it was the day after I had been teaching and standing around all day. My legs would just get so sore. But then we had a week at the beginning of November when there was no school, and I made a point of jogging almost every day, and that seemed to kind of build up the muscle again. And so now I don't have such painful legs after standing around all day at school. So I think I just built the muscle back up a bit.
Well, that's good. I mean, it's tying together.
All right. So we are on chapter 31, The Snake That Eats Its Own Tail.
Direct reference to the Ouroboros, right?
Yeah. So two things I noticed about this chapter. One, no Ed and Al. And two, lots of reveals.
Yes. Yeah, it's a big... It's a big revealing chapter. You're right. No Ed and Al.
Yeah, that's the first time that's happened, I think, since Hughes' murder.
Ah. And guess what gets mentioned?
Yeah, Hughes' murder. Which they apparently still don't know about.
Yeah, we don't know. Actually, we don't know. Yeah, there's no indication they've reacted to it.
No.
We start out like almost immediately after the end of the chapter, except...
Yeah, Mustang has arrived.
Mustang's arrived, yeah.
So it had been so long since we saw Mustang use his flame power that I was seeing him put the glove on and saying, there's going to be a fire tonight. Like, what? That's right. He's the flame alchemist? Something like that. It's been a long time since we were reminded of that.
One thing that I couldn't quite get... Okay. She's annoyed, but she's not like she's annoyed. You know what I mean? She's not like pissed, like super pissed. She's just like this guy, you know? She's annoyed. Like she's used to drunk guys trying to hit on her kind of aura here is what I'm getting, and so she's like annoyed. But Mustang is like, I think I have to kill him now. You know, he's like...
Yeah, well, he misunderstands why she's called him. He thinks that she just wants Mustang to get rid of the Smasher for her.
Oh, okay. Because I wasn't quite sure, like, why he's...
Well, I think that has to be the case, Because he sees Barry saying, "Hey, Toots, who's the chump?" And she says, "Quiet, you," and whacks him. So he says, "Stand aside, Lieutenant. There's going to be a fire tonight." And he puts his glove on. She says, "Please calm yourself, Colonel. This is Barry the Chopper, a convicted criminal who was supposedly executed."
I think what's hard, because it's not color, it's a little bit hard to read. He's holding on to her.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, okay, this is what he's pissed about. Because this is not just he's going to do a job. I felt he's angry, right? Because he's like, the fire of anger is building up in him. And, you know, the view we got of him is just his eyes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like, okay, here, let me blow him away for you. It's like he's angry is what I'm... And I don't know if it's because Barry called him Konoyaro, or like you said, a chump.
Yeah.
But I think it's more like he's being a little fresh with his subordinate, which, you know...
Well, is Barry holding her? Yeah, you're right. So this was a page that was originally color, but we're seeing it in black and white in the collection. So
yes, he's actually got both arms wrapped around her waist.
Okay.
The right hand, like I said, it's hard to read. The right hand is under her right breast, and the left arm is poking out of his
What do his hands even look like?
Cover. Okay, if you look, it's got like one free finger, and like three like mitten type fingers. That's why it's hard to read. Look on the page directly before from the previous story, the last page. If you look at his right hand pushed against the phone booth.
Well, maybe, but I mean, that thing that's under her right hand, it's colored in. It's not white.
I know, but I think that's because it's in color, maybe represented a little bit differently. Because even his armor looks darker than it does when it's just in black and white.
I do see the fringe from his sleeve, on his left hand.
Right?
Yeah. No, left.
But no, that's definitely his hand. That's a finger, and then the mitten part of the glove. I will stake my reputation on it.
Okay. All right. So
I think that's what it is. I think we're supposed to read it as, you know, like even Mustang can't do that. So why are you, you know, how come you can get away with it? I can't do it. You can get it. You know, like I've actually I was consoling a coworker. So she was crying, and I was consoling, and I had her in an embrace, and I was patting her back. And one of my Japanese coworkers said, "Oh man, you're lucky." Like, what? You know, and you know, it's because they are not except for in a romantic situation, like a hugging thing is not that common of a thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, but for us, it comes really natural if you're consoling someone.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I can see how they could read that as having other intentions, but that was not the case.
Yeah. So we got a splash page. This splash page doesn't even, or pages, it's a spread. This doesn't have Ed and Al on it. It's Hawkeye and Mustang and the rest of that crew around a table. Looks like Mustang and another guy whose name I've forgotten are playing chess.
Yes. So they don't show the chessboard clearly, but let me just ask you if you ever do this. If you see a chessboard in a comic or in a movie, do you try to analyze the game? Because I sure do. Oh. I pause it and I go, you know.
Not usually. I mean, if it's Star Trek, who can tell with that crazy chessboard?
A good point. You know, what you've only got, you have to move your black Googleplex to the seventh Bazinga Hog.
Yeah, to the other platform over there.
Then you've got full Fizbin.
Right. Yeah, here we can't see, like, from above. We can't see the board itself. We just see their pieces there. It's hard to tell how the game is going.
Oh, no, but I can tell because, see, there's only two black pawns taken, but Mustang has taken a pawn and a rook, it looks like.
Hmm. Yeah. So. A little hard to tell, but I was just noticing after that we have this mostly black page and Dorset is drawn here in white with a sword and it says there are worse things than living like a dog.
Yes, but except in Japanese, he's saying make inu, which means loser.
Hmm.
So.
Okay.
But so, you know, like in English, we do say like a dog as in like a loser.
Mm-hmm.
But in his case, like, he actually is part dog, so it's like, yeah. I think you have to clarify a little bit more. You have to push it in that direction.
Mm.
Like a, you know, like a damn dog. You know what I mean? Because otherwise, I think it's not. I mean, how did you read it? Did you read it like, yeah, he's a dog? Or did
you
like,
that's the first thing I thought of. Yeah, that's how I knew it was Dorset, because it mentions dog. Like, okay, yeah, that's Dorset.
He said, no, once in a while, it's okay to live like a loser dog. Yeah, which is curious.
Okay, so then we're in a warehouse somewhere with Hawkeye, Mustang, Barry, and Warrant Officer Fallman, new character. That's another thing about this chapter, several new characters.
He's not that new. I mean, is he?
I don't remember seeing him before. Was he involved in the investigation of Hughes' death?
Well, I think he was one of the crew that got recruited to go with Mustang to Central. Several short.
Now, he's not wearing a military uniform, so maybe that's why it didn't ring a bell. But yeah, I think.
But
you're right.
He is in the splash page though. He's wearing brocade.
Hmm. Oh, yeah. Probably must have been his day off, too, as well as Hawkeye's.
It's everybody's day off. Don't know.
Fallman is questioning Barry about the various murders that have been that he's been charged with and trying to make sure that he is really Barry the Butcher. Mm-hmm. But he passes the test. He doesn't fall in any of the traps when Fallman intentionally gives a date wrong and Barry corrects him like he's stupid. I killed Gradriel on the 13th, you idiot, not the 3rd. And again, with this comic, I mean, Barry is unapologetic for having killed all these people, and yet you kind of like him.
I know. I just watched the new Venom movie last night Screen X. Do you know what Screen X is?
No.
Okay, so I don't know if it's just Toho, but I think it's a Toho thing.
Mm.
You have a IMAX-like, I don't know if it actually measures up to IMAX screen. In other words, it's taller screen in front of you, and to the sides of you, there are two screens that come up the sides of the theater, and so it actually shows, it like projects, like 180 view for the action scenes. And for the movie Venom, which I thought is going to be, you know, a CGI slugfest, I think that's the kind of movie you want to spend the extra, the dough on to get a different experience. That was my first time to try Screen X. But that also is like focuses on a serial killer. Mm-hmm. And you don't really, I mean, like Woody Harrelson, he just nails everything. And even though you're like, oh God, that guy. But you still also, you know, he's got a charisma to him.
Mm.
And but this guy, he's just like, if you could, yeah, Barry. It's like he's just so true to who he is, and he's just done some awful, awful stuff. But somehow, somehow we're like, oh, Barry, you know, I don't know how does she pull that off?
And Mustang then asks him, like, if you were supposed to have been executed, what are you doing here? And how do you have a body of armor like Alphonse Elric? And Barry says he has a question of his own first, that you guys are all in the military, but you didn't know that they put me in this armor body, and so you don't know anything about Laboratory 5, and Mustang seems genuinely puzzled. Barry mentions that that's where he met Alphonse Elric and fought him. So I guess Mustang didn't know about them being in the laboratory that night. I don't remember exactly how that bit ended, other than with Ed in the hospital. And he realizes that, that Laboratory 5 must have been where they were developing the Philosopher's Stone.
Mm-hmm.
So he wants Barry to tell him more about that night, I guess, when Ed and Al were there. And so we jump ahead, because it's stuff that we would already know. And he's summing up that, Laboratory 5 was being used to create Philosopher's Stones, although it was still an imperfect formula. Main ingredients were human beings. The building collapsed, so it was impossible to search for evidence. And Mustang realizes that the military command must be involved to some degree if military personnel were involved. And also, he knows about lust and envy.
I love how he describes them both.
Yeah, he asked Barry to describe them. Yeah, lust is all va-va-voom. She looks real succulent. I'd love to get my cleaver into her. Could be double entendre. Envy's kind of bony. Not much meat on those bones. Full of gristle, I'd wager.
Well, so in the Japanese, I think that in English it's building a nice image, but like in Japanese, it's like he's basically judging them by how easy it would be to cut through their flesh. Like her flesh looks soft, easy to cut. His looks hard and no fun to cut. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So he likes a nice smooth cut. You know.
Okay. Yeah. That's. Well, I mean, it's obvious in what he says about lust, but not so much about envy. Because you can see how it fits, but not quite clear enough. So I was a little puzzled by Mustang's reaction, where he's sweating, and Barry says something wrong, and Mustang says, "No, that's enough." And the font is different. It looks really shaky.
Yeah, it's a weakened, you know, Moi. And it's because he explains everything from the point of view of how his knife goes through them, you know. And he's like, which doesn't really help.
Yeah, so it's not quite clear enough in the translation. And so Mustang wonders if envy and lust transmuted him into this body, but he says that was the researcher's job. And they didn't kill me first. They sucked my soul from my body while I was still alive and stuck it in this armor. But it was so painful, he wishes that they had just killed him.
Do you think, I mean, as far as we know, like, there's once that the soul is actually separated from the body, then, you know, a lot harder to get it back, but like so far the two successful or three successful joining of soul to armor have been living people that were still not quite both feet in the grave, you know what I mean? So I wonder if that's a factor, that they were alive, so it made it more feasible or more possible, unlike the mom.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not sure if they killed him first, it might have been impossible to get his soul to move it over to something else. It might have been gone already.
Yeah, well, you know, like, I mean, we know it's there. Like, the mom, something of the mom was there. We don't... but you're right. Maybe it wasn't her soul, though. Yeah, maybe it was because it was a soulless mass of quivering flesh that it turned out so poorly. So, yeah. So, yeah, being alive is probably a big... important part of making the transfer.
Fallman wonders if they could track down some of the personnel who worked there, but Barry says no, because they were used as ingredients for the stone just a few days before the building collapsed. So none of them are with us anymore.
Doesn't that remind you of like when somebody would build a castle with all kinds of secret entrances and stuff, and then they would like... bury the planners and architects in the foundation, you know, because they didn't want anyone to know the secrets of the castle or whatever, you know. It's like I've heard stuff about things like that, but it's that kind of thing. They're making a double use of those guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, as we're going through this, I'm thinking, you know, both with Al and with Barry, we originally meet them in this form. You know, we don't start out really with Al as a little kid, and we don't see, we still haven't seen, maybe we never see Barry's, what Barry's real body looks like. But I went just wondering how much differently it would read if we had seen them in their original bodies first and then see them in this form. That might be creepier.
Well, that is an amazing insight right there, Tim, because, I mean, if you look at what they look like in armor, they look like demons. They look like demons, but somehow they are cute.
Yeah, yeah.
They look like demons, but somehow they are cute. I mean, he looks like a skull demon. And it's not, you know, there's no way that's supposed to be cute, but it's something, the combination of just how, of his personality, not his actions, but his personality that somehow colors that. And yeah, if we would have seen, I don't know about Al, I'd have to think about it.
Well, I wonder with Al if it might have seemed, we might feel a stronger sense of like tragedy maybe, that like, oh, his body is gone and now he looks like this.
I think it's difficult because, for example, when you are a small kid, when you're like 11, 12 or whatever, and when you feel kind of powerless, to be able to have that kind of presence and power, that is actually kind of attractive, you know? So it's, you know, I mean, we know that he's on his mind, he's got it, you know, like, am I even real? Do I even exist? You know, he had to go through that, that process. Like, does he, you know, of course he must miss the physicality, eating food, touching and, you know, enjoying things. Can't swim, you know?
No.
So, yeah, you know, there is, of course, it is a tragedy, but I think it won't necessarily read like that automatically. I think, you know, like our first, I mean, our instinct is if we were him, I mean, if we were the same age as him and it didn't actually happen to us, it's very easy to think, wow. You know,
that's cool, man.
That's cool. Yeah. But I think that's one thing that that Arakawa tries to remind us again and again, without like really shoving in our face so that we're depressed all the time. Yeah. But she kind of tries to remind us that this is not a simple power fantasy of a little boy wanting to be Tom Hanks, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it, as far as Al's concerned, that goes hand in hand with what we discussed some episodes ago of, what if they had told the what if she had told the story completely in chronological order, and you know, start us out with young, very young Ed and Al, and see them going through the experiment and everything. And as I recall, we decided, well, that's not really what the story is about. That's just the background. And so it made more sense to make it a flashback once you were really introduced to them in their current form.
You're right. You're right. I mean, the story is not about the transition to this new form. And it could have been, you know, that could have been a story in itself. Like, I just finished giving this presentation on mermaids in Japanese comics. And a big theme throughout a lot of mermaid stories, and not just in comics, but like throughout history and folklore, is the transition part. You know, like how they change, what they have to give up, you know, What's funny is, like, the older stories, they're all about equivalent exchange. Like, if you want to change your body in order to move into a different world, then you have to pay quite a bit. You know, it's painful. It's not easy. And then modern mermaids are just like flip, 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 flip. Legs, no legs. Legs, no legs. I've got fins now. Now I've got legs. You know, you know, I'm wet. I'm a mermaid. I'm dry. I'm a person. You know, it's oh, can I mention something about that? I don't know if this ties in with Barry the Chopper. Do they call him Barry the Butcher in the English or Barry the Chopper?
Let's see.
Because I feel like I've referred to him as Barry the Butcher, but he's Barry the Chopper.
Yeah, it says Barry the Chopper.
Okay, because that's what it should be. But I think I've referred to him as Barry the Butcher. I just like the sound of it.
Somehow that sounds like something I remember from some other media property, Barry the Butcher.
Very possible. So there's one aspect of Japanese mermaids that is different. And I usually don't like to, like, Japanese are special, they are different, is not really, like, the stance that I'm aiming for. But in this case, it is completely true. Japanese eat mermaids. So,
Yeah.
We think of mermaids as, like, they're just people that happen to have different legs. But there's an old Japanese legend of the Yao Bikuni, the 800-year-old nun who ate the flesh of a mermaid and lived 800 years. She's shown up in, like, Tezuka's Hinotori, you know, Phoenix, and she's shown up in Blade of the Immortal. She's the one that gives the main character the worms that make him immortal. So this is tie between mermaid flesh and immortality or healing and stuff. And so the eating of the mermaid is, like, just this one theme that runs through decades and decades of Japanese comics that, you know, everybody, a lot of people know this legend and the eating the mermaid part. I asked them about it and they go like, yeah, that sounds weird, but, you know, it's somehow in the story, it's, you know, it happens. Hmm. So I don't know. I just want to mention that because it's fascinating to me.
By the way, I just found that there is an actual shop called Barry the Butcher in Stratford-upon-Avon in the UK.
Oh, God. I had my first boss in Japan. He's an English guy. He's originally from the boonies, right? Hmm. But he later moved to Stratford-upon-Avon. And so I think he had, you know, a little bit inferiority complex thing because every time he would say, I'm from Stratford-upon-Avon, birthplace of Shakespeare. It was just like one, like it was the whole name of the town. Where are you from? Stratford-upon-Avon, first birthplace of Shakespeare. You know, it's like, that's the name. They fit it on the sign and everything. You have to write in the address.
It's like Stately Wayne Manor or Millionaire Bruce Wayne.
Yeah, that's his actual first name is Millionaire.
Yeah.
Bruce is his middle name.
Yeah, exactly. Are you tired of fanboy comics podcasts? Looking for a show that really appreciates the comic storytelling medium and how it works? A show that looks at comics from any genre and anywhere in the world, comparing the storytelling techniques of different creators in different comics cultures, with manga, newspaper strips, European comics, and more discussed alongside mainstream US comics. A show that includes talks with well-known creators like James Robinson and Dan Jurgens, and with less famous creators that you really should know. And hey, we'll even critique your comic. If you're looking for that show, then you're looking for Deconstructing Comics, and it's right here at deconstructingcomics.com. Also available in iTunes and on Stitcher. This is Tim saying, check out our show on Wednesdays. That's Deconstructing Comics. Okay, so getting back to this comic, Mustang has one last question asking if he killed Hughes. Did you murder a military officer in a telephone booth a little over a month ago? And a couple of silent panels, and Barry says, it wasn't me. Was he cut up? No. If you don't know about it, that's fine. Forget it. So, but of course, we know that Barry didn't do it.
Yeah. And you know what? The way that the scene is set up so that he's openly discussing his past murders makes this very clear. Like, we don't have to go, is he telling the truth? You know, I mean, we can see why they would accept his word at face value.
Well, and he's already been executed. He's already, you know, been punished for it.
Well, you know, I mean, they can still rob him of existence, right? I suppose.
I guess. So Mustang is telling Fallman he can go, but Fallman says, well, you know, I can't just forget this, so I might as well stick with you till the end on this. So if there's anything more I can do, don't hesitate to ask.
Yeah, well, he tells him, you know, to forget what you've seen here, you know, so that you can go back to, you know, being innocent, because we're getting into some deep stuff. And he's like, but what he's saying is, you know, don't worry, I'm on board. And so he's saying, oh, I'm sorry, I've got the kind of brain that can't forget stuff like this. So I might as well just, you know.
Yeah. So Mustang asks him to keep an eye on Barry while he goes off and does some digging for information. And Fallman looks pretty shocked. And you even got a sound effect, kabam, as he's... like looking shocked and possibly sweating. Yeah, kabam. What is it in Japanese?
Go.
Okay.
Which is not a kabam. Go is more like if you're in a wind tunnel and the wind was like blowing by. Okay. That's more like the sound, and that's what these horizontal lines I think kind of evince. But the thing is that, you know, you expect when you tell somebody, yeah, just, you know, if you need anything, ask me. They're not really expecting you to. From propriety, you're supposed to say that. And from propriety, you're not supposed to ask anything. Mm-hmm. But he's like, oh, okay, well, I know you're on your day off, but could you spend the rest of it? No. He says, I'll go ahead and file the paperwork so that you'll be off work. So he's forcing him to use his paid vacation.
Yeah. And while you're at it, could you build a actual size Eiffel Tower out of macaroni?
Yeah. My dad would always say like, and could you do the windows? You know, just, you know, that was his thing about his joke about, can I ask you to do something, a favor?
Hawkeye says, and Barry, don't even think of chopping him up. And that's Barry, right? Says, aye, aye, honey. Heart.
Aye, aye. Yeah, a little heart. There's no honey in here, but yeah, it comes across
says to Fallman, you don't look like much fun to chop anyway. What do you say? Let's be friends. And Fallman's sweating and slapping his forehead.
Face palm.
Yeah. So then we switch to Central, apparently deep in the bowels of Central.
Where Akira is being kept.
Right. And Bradley is there in a dark room. He seems to be in the one light area of this room, talking with someone we can't see.
You know what I love? I love this tall panel where there's these clanking sounds.
The ong, ong, ong in English.
Yeah, yeah. I the atmosphere of, you know, the empty, like, underground, and then you hear the pipes and you hear things clanking.
Yeah, lots of concrete and pipes and air vents.
Like, I could hear it echo. Like, I really feel, I feel the atmosphere of it.
Yeah.
It's well done.
Yeah, that's true. And so this mysterious person is asking Bradley how his inspection of the South area went. And Bradley says, I've reassessed the Fullmetal Alchemist's brother, and I believe that he and their teacher might make worthy human sacrifices. Oh.
So apparently, like, there's a quality issue to the kind of, you know, it's like not just anybody will do, I guess. You know, like people of a certain caliber, I guess, or, you know.
But that's curious to me that someone who doesn't have a normal body, who is just a soul bound to a suit of armor, would be someone you would want to do a human sacrifice of. Because they aren't human in a way.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's the link itself that he's curious about, or maybe he doesn't quite understand the nature of Al's situation.
Right. We discussed last time he was asking about the link between Ed's automail and Al's armor. But yeah, I don't think he knows the whole story on that.
Mm.
And also, he's got Greed there, suspended from chains and bound to what looks like a broken concrete cross.
Yep.
With some spears in his torso.
Well, those are the swords. Those are Bradley's swords.
The swords, yeah.
Yeah. But the combined image of the cross and the spears, what this conjures up for me, besides the very obvious Christian, the very obvious, is like the very first Japanese comic I owned was Kamui Den, the original Legend of Kamui. And in that, there's a character that gets, like, speared, you know, up through the ribs from both sides. And I remember being how shocking that was, because it looked especially painful, you know. But, yeah, it's kind of tied in my head between that and then maybe another scene in Lone Wolf and Cub where they are sacrificing or crucifying Christians, you know.
Mm.
It just kind of, those things.
So lust, gluttony, and envy are also there. Greed wakes up and sees them, and they're kind of greeting each other. And he asks about Sloth, and Lust says, you know how he is, always slacking off. We have to keep him working. And there are a couple images of Sloth chained up in a cave somewhere. Apparently he's doing digging work or something.
You know, Sloth, like we think of it as like laziness, right?
Mm-hmm.
For a lazy bastard, he looks pretty buff.
Yeah. And Greed asks what Bradley's doing there, and Bradley says, I am Wrath.
Yeah, that's another reveal. He's one of the sins.
Yeah, he's a homunculus. But he's, unlike the others, he's a homunculus that ages, which Greed didn't even think was possible. But Envy says, nothing is impossible. You were the one who used to say that. Did you forget?
Yeah, that's right. Didn't he say that to Al when Al said, inconceivable? And then he said, I do not think that word means what you think it means.
And so there's some more banter between Greed and Envy. But then another voice, the person we haven't seen yet, says, stop it, all of you. And then we have a two-pager of a chair that has a bunch of tubes and pipes coming out of it. And someone with his back to us is sitting in the chair holding a book.
Yeah.
Now, of course, we remember who this is, having read the whole thing. Not that I remember a lot about reading the whole thing, but I do remember him.
As you know, every time I see these pipes, I think of Akira, but I'm also thinking of like Battle Angel, Alita, kind of, Gamma. A lot of that kind of machinery snaking all over the place, connecting to mysterious things. We have no idea what this machinery does.
No.
Or what's being piped in.
And so this person who has a beard calls himself their father. Enough of your sibling quarrels. Your father doesn't want to see such ugly behavior.
That's right.
And Greed comments, you've gotten a lot older since I last saw you, huh? Father asks, why did you betray your loving father? Why? You know that better than anyone, right? Greed. It's in my blood. It's who I am, because you made me that way. So because he's greedy, he couldn't be loyal to father. He had to run off and do other stuff.
I mean, isn't, like, this is the kind of flaw that we expect from our bad guys, you know? Whenever the League of Doom gets together, we kind of, I hope at least, that one of the reasons they can't win is because they shouldn't be able to get along, you know?
Mm-hmm.
In the end, their characters are supposed to, you know, come out, and that's why you know, they're evil, so they are flawed, so they shouldn't be, they shouldn't have a better time of working together than the heroes do.
No.
But sometimes, no. You know.
If the group of bad guys is all sweetness and light and cooperation, something's wrong.
Yeah, and my worldview, basically, my worldview gets destroyed, but unfortunately, even in the real world, sometimes it seems like evil is a lot more coordinated.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I wonder what book this guy's reading. He's got, there's the Tree of Knowledge, the Kabbalistic, mm-hmm. right? The Sephiroth, mm-hmm. I think it's called. The Tree of Knowledge page, I noticed that, which is a continued motif in mm-hmm. this series.
So Father asks, will you stay here and work for me again, my son? But Greed says, no, never. So he's not going to cooperate. So Father dips him in this bubbling liquid that dissolves him.
Yeah, it's Dip from Roger Rabbit.
Oh, do you remember that? I saw that movie once, like in 1988, and I remember that
Tim,
now that you mentioned it.
Tim, you did not. I showed it to my daughter recently. You know, it's, I think it's, you know, it's part of your duty as a father, because then you get to point out, see, that's Betty Boop, and you know, and that's, you know, yeah, you get to point out all these old characters and thing, and look, Mickey Mouse and Bugs Bunny.
Well,
in the same movie.
The main thing I remember enjoying about that movie was that I finally got my childhood dream of seeing Donald Duck and Daffy Duck together.
There you go. There you go. Well, see, like, for me, it was more also, like, my daughter had already been on the Toontown ride, the Roger Rabbit ride at Disneyland. Mm. And so now, finally, could tie some context mm-hmm. into that. Because Dip, which is the green... It's acetate, like it's the green liquid they use to destroy animated characters, which are apparently harder to kill because, you know, their reality is warped. So that's what this is, exactly what this reminded me of. I'm very intertextual, you know.
Mm-hmm. So over the course of a few pages, he's dropped in this liquid and melted down as he's saying, and well... Father says, go back to the place you were born. Go back into my soul, Greed. Greed says, fine by me, Dad, but don't blame me if you get sick. And after he's melted down, we see, you know, the tubes and test tubes, and this black liquid ends up in a wine glass, and Father drinks it.
But, I mean, you know, here's a character who just... A few chapters ago, we were like, oh, God, he's going to be really hard to kill. And he's, you know, a conceited jerk. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we hate him. But now, like, here at the end, he's, like, so true to himself.
Mm.
You know, he won't even lie. He's just, like, so true to himself. He's like, nope, you're just going to have to kill me.
Yeah.
And he laughs all the way down.
Mm-hmm.
That is a badass, you know? He laughs all the way down, and he's like, ha, 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 ha. And so that's, now I have so much more respect.
Yeah, we've got a full page of ga, ha, 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 as he's going into the vat, and all this alchemical energy, lightning bolts coming out of it, and, Bradley and Lust are standing there in front. Oh, yeah, and you could see Gluttony sitting there also.
Where's Gluttony?
Just oh, in front of Lust.
I see him. His head and arm look like a duffel bag to me for a second. So round.
Yeah. So after Father has swallowed the liquid, then we're back outdoors at Central, and... Bradley is there, and here's another reveal, approached by his wife and son. Mm. And I completely forgotten about his wife and son, and now I'm feeling like the son becomes important sometime later, I think, but I don't remember how.
Foreshadowing. No, you know what? I don't remember at all. So, but I just, you know, so, but when they get revealed, I do feel like, ah, so he's able to have kids, so, mm-hmm. you know, he's... there's a lot more human aspect to him. But he's anger, you know, that's interesting. He's anger, but we often see him... Wrath, that's right. But we often see him with a smile on his face.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that gap right there is pretty scary, pretty creepy. And we also, like, we learned just a little while ago why he wears that eye patch.
Yeah, that hides the fact that he is a homunculus. He has the Ouroboros in his eye.
That's the best eye patch reveal, I think, you know, in any media. Because usually an eye patch reveal, even if it's something different...
Rather than an injured eye.
Yeah, but it's not like a huge plot point, you know what I mean? Mm. It's the huge plot point under the eye patch, not just some secret power reveal or something like that. One of my favorite eye patch characters is, I think it's the last action hero bad guy. Because he changes his glass eye. No, he doesn't wear an eye patch, but he has a glass eye, and he changes it like every scene. And sometimes it's got like a smiley face. And it's just like, you know, I love that guy. And then other eye patch character I like is, there's a Japanese animation called Chunibyo Sore demo koe shitai. It's something like that. It's like I've got chunibyo, second grade, junior high school disease, but I still want to fall in love. Is how, you know, it's a rough translation. And that disease is like when you're escaping from reality. You're in a fantasy world, but then when you move into high school, it's time to stop playing around and get rid of your fantasies. But this is kids who have not quite given up on their fantasies. And there's this one character who, the main boy, he's definitely like, no, it's a new start for me. I'm no longer a nerd. And in high school, nobody knows me. I'm going to be cool, and I'm going to work hard and all this stuff. And he goes, so for the very last time, I'm no longer the dark flame wizard. And he does his dark flame spell one more time. And this girl who's in his class sees him, and she starts calling him dark flame wizard, you know, and he's like, shut up. But the brilliant thing about that show is that they do these fight scenes where they're imagining him in their heads. And we see that. Mm. We see these grand, awesome, special effect fight scenes. And then they switch back to reality, and they're just like rolling on the tatami mats with brooms. And so I love that.
So kind of like Calvin being Spaceman Spiff or something.
Exactly like that. Exactly like that. Except when you flip back, he's like in his underwear. You know, it's like it's really sad.
So Bradley's son is called Selim.
Yes.
And he's a fan of Ed. He says it's so cool that he became a state alchemist when he was only 12. I wish I could learn alchemy too. He wants to get a state license and help his dad. And so the family is walking away, and that's the end of the chapter.
Well, but he doesn't say like, okay, Selim, you know, you can be whatever you want to be. He says, nah.
Yeah. Keep dreaming, Selim. Keep dreaming.
Yeah. He said it. Impossible for you. Yeah, so a lot of things revealed.
Yeah, we're moving a lot more into the main story here.
That's right. We're not even halfway in, but I feel like a lot of this stuff, and I think we've talked about this before, a lot of this stuff is revealed a lot earlier than I remember. You know?
Uh-huh.
But I didn't remember details, which is, I think, one of my advantages, is I'm one of the people that can read a mystery, and then as soon as I put it down and go to sleep and wake up the next day, now who was the killer? I just can't remember. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something in my brain that says, nope, you're going to read this again someday.
So erase.
That's right. That's
clear
right.
The memory bank. Okay. Yep. So that's chapter 31.
Yes, it is.
So, join us next time, and don't forget, the law of equivalent exchange means...
you get what you pay for.
Yep. Okay. See you next time.
Next time.
Our theme is Cryosyncope by Winterfiend. You can follow us on Twitter at LOEE Podcast or email us at LOEEpodcast@deconstructingcomics.com. Our website is loee.buzzsprout.com. Support our show on Patreon at patreon.com/deconcomics. See you in 2 weeks. The Law of Equivalent Exchange is a production of DeconstructingComics.com. Outtakes. We forget characters' names. I don't remember seeing him before. Was he, or was he involved in the investigation of, I can't remember. Hughes's death.
It's everybody's day off.
And I forgot his name already. What is it? Fallman. Fallman is...
Yeah, that's right. Didn't he say that to Ed? Or was it to Al? To Al, when Al said...
See you next time.